Hello again, everyone. We are so excited to be here at ASN Kidney Week in Houston with live coverage on Late Breakers. And I am incredibly honored and excited to get to interview my mentor, Dr. Brad Rovin, who many of you know from the world of glomerular diseases in general, and has really been a key force in all glomerular diseases, but particularly lupus nephritis. And so for those who don't know, Dr. Rovin is the Division Chief of Nephrology at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, and is here today to talk about his late breaker regarding the Regency trial. So, Dr. Rovin, it is so nice to have you on the podcast.
It's great to see that my fellows are successful. That's, you know, that's the best thing that something can a mentor can have. So congratulations on your podcast series. So yeah, we do have some exciting data. You want me to give some background on Regency just to get everyone up to speed?
If you can share kind of, you know, for those who don't know, the Regency trial in lupus nephritis is actually published earlier this year. It was presented at the World Congress of Nephrology and resulted in a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine. So it would be great for our listeners to kind of understand the background of why was this study something that was really important for us to do and what's the study design?
Yeah, so we know that B cells and antibodies are important for lupus nephritis. That's clear. And lupus in general. And so many years ago, we did a trial called the LUNAR trial of rituximab. And I participated in that, and we were sure we were going to cure lupus nephritis. And of course, that didn't happen. And the trial was actually unsuccessful. It didn't meet its endpoint. But what it did show in a post hoc analysis was that the patients who actually did get good B cell depletion with rituximab had an advantage over the patients who did not in terms of achieving complete renal response. And so this sort of, to me, was the first inkling that the depth of B cell depletion may actually be relevant to the responses. And so one of the other drugs that's an anti-CD20, so it kills CD20-positive B cells, is obinutuzumab. And obinutuzumab was developed for malignancies. And when it was compared with malignancies, it actually showed better resolution of any residual disease. And the suggestion was it got into tissues better, okay? And so not only did it get into tissues better and kill B cells, it was a very potent peripheral B cell eliminator, if you will, and much more so. So it's called a class 2 or a type 2 anti-CD20. It doesn't rely on complement to kill the cells, and it's not taken up by the lipid rafts and recycled away. We felt that obinutuzumab would be much more effective in lupus nephritis because of some of these attributes. And so the Regency trial was, well, before the Regency trial, we did a phase 2 trial called the Nobility trial. And that actually was a successful phase 2, showing a good effect size with significance of obinutuzumab versus placebo plus a background of mycophenolate and steroid. And so that led to the phase 3 Regency trial. The Regency trial was designed as two arms with obinutuzumab, and that had doses every 2 weeks, every 6 months, two doses every 6 months for a year, or two doses, and for the 1 year, it was one dose. And that was at the request of the FDA to see about tolerability and how much dosing. But it turned out those two arms were identical. So you can say there was an obinutuzumab arm with obinutuzumab added to mycophenolate plus steroid, and then a placebo to mycophenolate and steroid. And the trial ran for 76 weeks. And the upshot of it was, the top line data was that this was the first successful phase 3 anti-CD20 in lupus nephritis trial showing a significantly increased proportion of complete renal responses in the obinutuzumab-treated patients. And some of the secondary endpoints included an analysis of GFR over time. And although this didn't reach statistical significance, it was important because the GFR improved in the obinutuzumab group and it actually declined in the placebo group. It also appeared that the lupus nephritis flare rate was less, significantly less in the obinutuzumab group, and I think the hazard ratio was like 0.44. So these all suggested that this drug was providing important benefits in patients with lupus nephritis. Now, for the late breaker that we just did, the idea was, could we understand what's actually happening in the tissue in patients that are treated with placebo or with obinutuzumab? And we had a voluntary repeat biopsy study. So just for everyone who's listening, patients coming into obinutuzumab, the Regency trial, had to have a fairly recent, within 6 months at the outset, but most of the patients were closer to the time of starting, a kidney biopsy showing active lupus nephritis. And this was class 3 and 4, plus or minus class 5. And we offered these patients an optional rebiopsy at week 76, which is the primary endpoint of the trial. Now, just for everyone, we're continuing the trial forward to get more data on long-term GFR and things of that nature, relapse rate. And so it turned out that 64 patients consented, which is about the largest that I've ever seen repeat biopsy study. And 32 were in the obinutuzumab arm, and 32 were in the placebo arm. And so we had several questions, and we're still in the process of interrogating all of the repeat biopsies. But one of the important questions was, what happens to the activity index of patients? And as expected, the activity index in the obinutuzumab group dropped significantly from the time of initiation to week 76 compared to the placebo group. And of course, that makes sense. We had more complete renal responses. We looked at the activity index in two ways. One is an activity index of zero. So we sort of define complete histologic remission as an activity index of zero. You know, I think we need to think a little bit, maybe a little more liberal on that. I don't know. My partner in doing repeat biopsies, Anna Malvar from Buenos Aires, wants an activity index of zero. But the reading of an activity index is fairly subjective right now. In the future, if it may be digital and machine reading, it could be more consistent. But that's a different discussion. Nonetheless, we also looked at getting down to an activity of one or less. And again, we saw a much higher proportion of the obinutuzumab patients achieving that. And then what we did, which I think is really sort of the highlight of this study, is we looked at the patients who had not achieved a complete renal response clinically. So in other words, they didn't qualify by GFR criteria, proteinuria criteria, et cetera. And we compared in that group, what did it look like in the obinutuzumab-treated patients versus the placebo-treated patients? It turns out that about 50% of those patients who didn't achieve a complete renal response clinically achieved an activity index of zero after having been treated with obinutuzumab. And that was much higher than what we saw in the placebo group, where I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was quite a bit lower. So that sort of confirms, in a well-conducted, placebo-controlled, well-phenotyped population of patients, what we and others have been sort of getting at for years, which is sometimes in a person who has had lupus nephritis for a while, you may not achieve or be able to achieve a proteinuria less than this arbitrarily defined value of 500 milligrams per day. And yet, those patients may, on histology, have a complete remission, a complete histologic remission. And let's face it, I mean, this is what we want. We want the kidney to be returned to an uninflamed state. And so this was very encouraging. And the way I would interpret the data is that this tells us that we are potentially underestimating the complete renal response rate when you think about this as holistically including the kidney parenchyma in our trials. Mm-hmm. And so maybe when we say the trial, only 50% of the patients achieved complete renal response, that's clinical. But maybe it's another 20%, et cetera. You see my point.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think this is really important. These drugs may be doing a lot better than what the trial endpoint shows. And so I think that's important for us to think about. Now, I don't want to imply that for every trial, every patient has to have a repeat biopsy to define this. And as you know, many of us are working in the laboratory to find other measures that would be non-invasive to understand activity in the kidney, chronicity, et cetera. And so this is now realistic. There are some markers out there that will be good. But it really does speak to the fact that things that are going on in the kidney cannot always be interpreted by simply looking at proteinuria in GFR. There's Absolutely. More to it. So the second part that's very exciting, and I think really speaks towards this idea of depth of B-cell depletion, is that we also quantified B-cell depletion from the kidney tissue and plasma cell depletion from the kidney tissue. And very remarkably, we saw almost total B-cell depletion from the obinutuzumab-treated patients compared to really a level number of B-cells in the kidneys of patients before and after treatment in the placebo group. And remarkably, anti-CD20 drugs don't really kill plasma cells. But of course, some of the short-lived plasma cells that might turn over quickly or plasma blasts, there was about a 50% reduction in plasma blasts and plasma cells in the kidney tissue after obinutuzumab treatment that was not seen in the placebo group. And so now we really are getting towards what we might be seeing in the cell therapies, which is really B-cell depletion from the tissues completely. So this is very exciting. And it speaks to the fact, you know, to sum it up, it speaks to the fact that I think this drug, this anti-CD20 agent, is actually working and doing more things than are obvious just from the clinical trial endpoint. And I think maybe we need to think about that in all our clinical trials.
Yeah. So, you know, you touched on a couple of really important things. One is we've been talking for years about, you know, clinical remission and histologic remission are not equivalent in lupus nephritis. And I think this study shows exactly that. And I think I'm wondering, you know, as things have evolved over time, the trial design of lupus nephritis trials has changed, right? Because initially we wondered, are we getting the right patients into trials and are we using the right endpoints? And I'm wondering, based on now this really rich and well phenotyped biopsy data, do you think it's going to change how we approach clinical trial design in the future? Because, you know, there's all the rage about, you know, composite endpoints or hierarchical composite endpoints, for example. Mm-hmm. And right now, the CRR, as you mentioned, is really a composite of proteinuria less than 0.5, the GFR, and then not having, a kidney failure type of event or, a non-response.
Some of them want a reduction in steroids too.
Yes, which is all very important too. Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's a whole another conversation that's very important in this disease because of the obvious toxicities. But could you envision that we perhaps now, given, you know, this repeat biopsy data, should we be thinking about some kind of composite endpoint that includes histology? You know, this has been done in C3G and
successfully, by the way.
And I wonder, you know, we all think that our patients really don't want repeat biopsies. And then we put them in trials and we're often surprised that a significant number are willing to do a repeat biopsy if it's going to inform our decision making and change management. And as you said, you know, in the absence of really a perfect biomarker that can predict, because we know that proteinuria clearly is not the perfect biomarker, do you think that we need to be moving in the direction of including, you know, repeat biopsies, which is your favorite topic, into clinical trial endpoints? Or are we not quite ready for prime there?
So, you know, my obvious answer would be yes, of course. I'm going to be a little bit more nuanced, and you'll tell me how much you tolerate me blathering on about things. What this tells me, and this is really important for now looking at CAR T-cell therapies, and I'm lumping into CAR T-cell therapies, the T-cell engagers, things that really are depleting and are being restricted right now as clinical trials to refractory patients. It's clear to me that what we need, we keep talking about precision medicine to give patients treatment. We need precision endpoints. Mm-hmm. I think we need to start thinking about how do you define, and this will be a nightmare for any of the statisticians that are listening, how do we think about defining an endpoint based on what could be expected from that patient's kidneys? So in other words, excuse me, if you have pristine kidneys that have never been damaged, my expectation is if I treat you, you're going to be able to achieve a low level of proteinuria, maybe have the proteinuria go away, maintain your GFR, et cetera. If you've had kidney disease for a while, and this doesn't have to be lupus, but we're talking about lupus. If you've had lupus with several flares and you've accumulated a significant amount of damage, as you well know, you'll never get the proteinuria down. And it's sort of silly to enroll a patient in a trial who's had chronic proteinuria of 700 milligrams, and then they flare, and then expect that person to go down below that. So I do think that we need to start thinking about how we can individualize and make endpoints appropriate for the individual patient. I think this is exactly what we do in clinical practice, and we need to figure out some way how to do that in a clinical trial. And we've actually written a little editorial that will hopefully come out detailing some of this. Now, more importantly is what do we do now? And I think that it's very difficult to design a trial where there's absolutely an endpoint where there has to be a biopsy. Mm-hmm. I was so excited to read the C3G trials where they actually did require this of the adult patients, not the kids, mm-hmm. but still. And I think it provided a huge amount of information about how the drug was working and the pharmacodynamics of the drug. It was wonderful. I do think that that could be what we do in lupus. But again, there are now some clinically relevant biomarkers. They haven't achieved approval yet, but they seem to correlate, urine biomarkers, they seem to correlate very nicely with the activity index. And one of them, as you know, from when you were in the lab, is urine CD163. And at this meeting, we'll have a poster showing the same sort of thing in kids with lupus, that CD163 does very well correlate with activity. And so my hope is, could we start using these biomarkers in our lupus trials, lupus nephritis trials, well phenotype patients, and then in a proportion with the repeat biopsies, now we're using these biomarkers prospectively. And if we can do that, can we then incorporate them into clinical care? So I think before we have the absolute answer to the question as to whether we absolutely need biopsies or can use something else, there's going to be a biopsy period because we have to relate to the histology. But I think this is all doable. And I think, again, for the viewership, what you said, you sort of said it fast, is profoundly important. If you don't ask the patient if they would like to do a repeat biopsy, they're not going to say yes because they have nothing to say yes to. If you ask the patient and you explain why, a high percentage of patients will say okay. And I think we tend to shy away from doing that as a group, as a subspecialty. And I think it gives us a lot of information that hopefully in the future will allow us not to need to do repeat biopsies. So I think we have to take the plunge a little bit, but I think we also have to talk to the patients. And that's really important because they are pretty savvy about, you know, if you're doing a clinical trial, you're already invested in sort of pushing the field forward. And if the biopsy will help do that, a lot of patients want to take advantage of that. And of course, you know, it has to be done safely. It should be done in centers that are experienced, you know, safety first. But I think that's all doable.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other thing that, you know, we've talked about from a lot of the work you've done with Anna Melvar, when there's been, you know, protocol biopsies, when we're just looking at, you know, lupus nephritis, we see that over time, the second biopsy, the third biopsy, we tend to see an increase in the chronicity index, regardless of whether that person now has an activity index of zero. And I think, you know, when we're thinking long term, these are young patients who, you know, have their life ahead of them, and we're trying to preserve kidney function long term. We know that repeat flares are bad, but even in those patients who we think are doing okay, and we do a protocol biopsy, we see that on average, the chronicity index increases. Can you talk about what we see with, you know, and I know it's a small group of patients, but like with obinutuzumab, are we seeing anything with a chronicity index, or is it one of those things, like you said, where it needs to really be divided up against the people that, you know, where they started? If they already had a significant amount of chronicity, that's not going to get better.
Right.
But the people who maybe started off with a CI very low of like 1-2, are we able to preserve that? Or are we still seeing worsening chronicity on the second biopsy at 76 weeks?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And, you know, the hope was that we would see chronicity at biopsy 1 with a horizontal line to chronicity at biopsy 2. That's not what we saw in aggregate. So both the control, the placebo, as well as the OB went up slightly. So it was a positive slope, suggesting there was a small increase in chronic damage. Now, I don't want to water that down at all. I think that's important. We did want to see a horizontal line. We haven't done the granular analysis like you just suggested, and that's absolutely doable and something we want to do. But we also, I want to give a little bit more time, because you say, well, a year and a half, that's pretty good. But I wonder what's going to happen over time to that chronicity index. And the point you made about flares is key in this, right? Because with every flare, we accumulate more damage. And the fact that obinutuzumab and other B-cell drugs seem to stabilize the patient from flaring is another attribute that I think adds to why these drugs are helpful for our individuals with lupus and lupus nephritis. Preventing flares is really important. And, you know, if we can do that at the same time we're controlling the disease activity, that's great.
Yeah.
Right.
So. And I think the other thing is, you know, unlike some of our other kidney, you know, focused diseases, lupus is a systemic disease. And I think as nephrologists, we're, of course, focused on lupus nephritis, but we also have to think about the patient as a whole. We work very closely with our rheumatology colleagues. And we don't want them to flare in their kidneys. We also don't want them to flare outside of the kidneys.
Yes.
And I think the beauty of, you know, these types of drugs is that I think, you know, they can have an impact outside of the kidney as well at controlling their overall lupus activity.
And just to make that point, it was announced at the end of last week that the Allegory study, which is obinutuzumab in non-renal lupus, met its primary endpoint and all of its secondary endpoints, suggesting, as you say, that this works at the kidney level and at the systemic level. And I think, again, that's something we need to think about. Now, our experience, as you know, as nephrologists, we often see the patients with nephritis. A lot of times they may have a little bit of extrarenal, but it's usually dominated by nephritis. But that doesn't mean that they don't have other issues, and it also doesn't mean that they might not develop those issues down the road. So having obinutuzumab, you know, again, this is not published yet. It was just an announcement of the top line analysis, and obviously it will be published and put forward. But having a drug that hits both the systemic process as well as local is really sort of good for the patient. You know, it's sort of maybe the hope is in the future, we know, and we discuss this all the time, adherence and ability to adhere is very difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't take a vitamin a day, let alone if I had to take 16 pills a day. And so, you know, drugs that do multiple things and act at multiple levels of the disease, I think are key.
Yes. And I guess, you know, the other thing is that this comes up too, right? So all of these patients in any of our, you know, recent trials in lupus nephritis, they are on a background of prednisone and mycophenolate or in some cyclophosphamide, which is left up to the investigator. But the other thing I think that people worry about is, and we keep adding more immunosuppressive or immunomodulatory therapy, you know, number one, do we need to be concerned about infections? But number two, I think I'm beginning to wonder, do we still need that background mycophenolate? And I'm wondering, you know, where do we go from here? Because clearly these patients are doing better on triple therapy. And we can, you know, of course, talk about trying to taper steroids very quickly, maybe going steroid free. But what about, you know, is that mycophenolate like 100% necessary? Or could we look at sort of this, you know, therapies like obinutuzumab as being a standalone with maybe a little bit of steroids or something up front?
Yeah, I think the steroids are important right off the bat because we don't have very many drugs that control inflammation if there's a lot of inflammation right now, very quickly. Then I think steroids have potentially served their purpose. I absolutely agree with you. I think what the future holds for us as a community, in addition with our rheumatology colleagues, is can we start to take some of these drugs, put together some, maybe on the smaller side, investigator-initiated trials to look at this question. Because to me, you know, mycophenolate is sort of a modest B-cell drug. It's sort of a modest T-cell drug. But we have T-cell drugs like the calcineurin inhibitors. We have B-cell drugs like obinutuzumab and belimumab that are professional drugs, and we can hit these parts of the system. We have a small trial that was investigator-initiated, started up, and if any of the readers have patience, viewers, sorry, this is a podcast, I'm too old-fashioned. If any of the viewers would like to consider, the trial is quite interesting. It's steroid, mycophenolate, belimumab, and voclosporin, two arms. And then in one of the arms at 3 months, no matter what, the MMF is stopped. And then the trial continues for a year to look at the endpoints and compare between the two groups. So the idea is, can we, baby steps, can we start with mycophenolate and get rid of it? That's step one. And then the next, if that's successful, can we just eliminate the mycophenolate, period? And when I designed the trial with Jim Tumlin, you know, I wanted to have no mycophenolate. And our sponsor sort of said, well, nobody's going to enroll a patient into that trial. I said, I bet they would. But anyway, we made a compromise. Life is compromises, right? So we made a compromise. But I think we can take, if this is successful, the next question is your question. can we start to bring these therapies down because they're so effective at what they do? And that benefits our patients considerably because the other side effects of mycophenolate are profound, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about nausea and vomiting. Take a patient off mycophenolate and they feel 100% better. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of other things that mycophenolate makes you, how you feel. So I think the answer to your question is yes. I think it's incumbent upon us as a community of investigators to start to think about putting these trials together. I think in my discussions with pharma, they're very interested in looking on how they drugs may be combined to achieve greater efficacy for our patients. So I think this is the right time mm-hmm. to do this sort of thing. This is like the perfect time in my entire career, actually.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you mentioned this earlier, the pill burden is just becoming astronomical for these patients. And a lot of these are, you know, predominantly young women who may never have been on any medication, and all of a sudden they walk into our offices and we're handing them, you know, multiple
buckets of pills.
Yeah. And then you got to have your hydroxychloroquine in there, you add in your ACE inhibitor, you add in your calcium vitamin. I mean, it's just an enormous amount. And then we wonder why we have trouble with compliance, especially when some of these drugs don't make you feel good. Now we have newer therapies that, you know, seem to have a better side effect profile. And maybe, you know, it's a couple of infusions, subcutaneous injection, what have you, instead of, you know, six pills a day plus another three pills a day plus another, you know, yada, yada, yada. So, no, I think this is incredibly exciting, and congratulations to you and the team on, I think, a very well-designed biopsy study and very, you know, useful in terms of answering some of those questions that we've all had for a long time about, you know, whether this is, you know, whether the clinical response is actually correlating with that histologic remission. And if not, then where do we go from here? So, you know, we're really thrilled and excited to see where this field goes forward. And thank you so much for being on our podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.